This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to Go Home in a Box. After a week off, we are your podcast source for all things related to genre films from the VHS era. We traverse the dusty shelves of your mom and pop video store looking for that one treasure. Some people have the audacity to ignore a title like Microwave Massacre. We embrace it here at Go Home in a Box and we give it a good home. I'm one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where last week you would have had the opportunity to read my review of the Stephen King adaptation, Needful Things, with Ed Harris and Max von Sydow. It's also the place where this week you will find a review of one of the all-time biggest box office bombs in Super Mario Brothers, with Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo playing the Brooklyn-born plumbers, and Dennis Hopper as some sort of evolved dinosaur. What more can you say? You can find that review right now at RetroMovieNerd.com. Joining me, as always, is a man who is fresh from his soul-searching journey in the Himalayas, where he learned the mysterious art of Shaq Fu. It's Joel LaPuma.
Well, thank you for that, Chris. I have to tell you, the secret is that Shaq Fu was inside all of us to begin with.
It's inside me, too?
In all of us. It's in all of our hearts, as long as you believe in Shaq.
I have to reach inward and find my inner Shaq.
Agreed. We all do. But, no, you can find me at Razor Candy at razor-candy.com. And soon we've got an article making fun of cheap, pulpy 80s and 90s horror paperback covers, and I'll have an article. Lately, I've been reading a lot of older, classic, young adult fantasy adventure stories, yeah. So Earthsea, The Darkest Rising, things like that, stuff I was too serious to actually read when I was that age. Yeah, I was a serious man. I had real books to read. So now I'm sort of going back to see what I missed. But so I'll have a review of those up probably next week after I finish a few more.
So what did you do? Did you go from Nancy Drew straight to Clive Barker?
Yeah, I went from Goosebumps to Stephen King, basically.
All right. That's a slight upgrade then.
And I apologize to our audience for neglecting you for the past week, because apparently we leave for 1 week and Steven Spielberg decides to waste his time on an 80s video game mashup film.
Well, yeah, I've
have you seen the trailer for Ready Player One?
I've seen the trailer, and I have mixed feelings, but parts of it were quite awesome.
I just feel like anybody could have directed that. Like, why did it need Steven Spielberg?
Oh well. Until someone steps to the plate, Steven Spielberg will, in terms of Hollywood box office, he'll be the king.
I just feel like I would have been more interested, and not that I'm going to be interested in like another nostalgia mashup anyway, because like I don't even like Stranger Things, and I've been excoriated for that before. I just feel like that's the kind of film that you could give to some up-and-coming indie guy and just see if he can make it work, or else, like, flame out Josh Trank style.
Hey, that reminds me that I recently watched Cobra.
Cobra.
Earlier in the week, and I have not seen it in a long time. And let me tell you that I was just blown away. I mean, this is probably now near the top of one of my all-time favorite action films from the 80s. And, it hit every trope, every cliche you could name And it just, you know, it inspired me to wanna write some kind of nostalgic throwback, you know, screenplay that were, you know, we could. I just think it's time. I think it's time that, you know, we had a movie that looked like it could have been made in the 80s. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you know, I'm cool with like throwback style. I just like when it's not so obtrusive, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking mine would probably be obtrusive, Joel.
It's hard not to be when you're inspired by Cobra, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we want to touch briefly on the passing of two major figures in genre films, Joel. And one of those, of course, being the great director George Romero, director of, you know, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, etc. You know, he's just basically the zombie movie patriarch, the king of the zombie movie. And he passed away earlier in the week, last week, by the time you hear this. And so we just wanted to just give him a brief in memoriam. And he was quite, I guess, inspirational for future horror film directors.
Yeah, I mean, the guy invented a genre, basically.
Yeah, and a genre that's still going strong today. I mean, even on the independent film circuit, you know, you can go on Netflix or Amazon and you can find any number of, you know, zombie films from the current era. You may not have heard of them, but, I mean, basically, if there's a zombie movie, there's someone behind it who has seen Night of the Living Dead and so on and so forth. And so, you know, it was quite a blow to the genre film, you know, circuit. And we want to just wish George Romero rest in peace, sir. And along the same lines, Mr. Martin Landau passed away not soon after. I believe they passed away on the same day, Joel.
I think it might have been, because yeah. I remember at the very least hearing about it the same day. And, you know, Martin Landau's career just is absolutely fascinating. I mean, the ups and downs and different, you know, not in a very dramatic way that some actors with personal problems have, but I mean, just the man went from doing, you know, Gilligan's Island meets the Harlem Globetrotters to winning an Oscar.
Right.
Like the entire gamut of potential acting career moves occurred within the man's career. It's really fascinating just to watch the different stuff he's done and how much he puts into every role, regardless of whether it's, you know, Ed Wood or Without Warning.
Right. And, you know, don't forget, he was also, you know, quite familiar with the small screen as well, with television, with, you know, various television programs he was on. I believe he was in Mission Impossible.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite television moments of all time is at the MTV covering the premiere of Mission Impossible, and one of the VJs asking Martin Landau why he was there, and him being so incensed that they didn't know he was in the original show that he came back to argue with her a second time. It was amazing.
Yeah, that I'm sorry I missed that. I've got to go see if I can find that on YouTube or something.
Oh, that's got to be on YouTube. I know it's uncovered in like other like MTV retrospectives before. It is a beautiful moment.
Yeah, of course, my favorite of him, of course, was in Ed Wood, you know, as Bela Lugosi and the heroin addicted late era Bela. And my favorite scene in Ed Wood is after he's gone and shot up, he immediately comes on set, you know, energetic, and he's like, "All right, let's shoot this fucker."
Oh my god, it's a brilliant performance. I mean, it's heartbreaking and it's funny, and he's just so good in it. And I was lucky enough to meet Martin at a con, actually probably less than a year ago. I think it was.
Yeah, that's awesome, dude.
Yeah, no, really nice guy. Like, totally swag, by the way. I mean, the dude was dressed so well. And I mean, that stands out more. And that stands out even more when you're at a con full of, like, sweat t-shirt guys. But, like, But just really, really polite, really sweet guy. Like it was. I'm so glad I got to meet him and talk and tell him how great he was and like everything I've ever seen him in.
That's a good story, Joel, and that's a good sign off for that segment. So, George Romero, Martin Landau, may you both rest in peace, good sirs. Thank you for the memories that you provided on the small and big screens. Absolutely. Okay. Okay, we've got some new releases to catch up on, Joel, so we'll head on over to the new release section here. Let's take a look at stuff that's come out just this past week. A small handful of releases here, a couple of them from Kino Lorber. We'll start there. The first one of note, from 1988 on Blu-ray, it's Freeway, which is basically the plot is a killer stalking the freeway of Los Angeles. I think the casting is more interesting than maybe the actual story, because you've got Richard Belzer as a radio personality, and Billy Drago's in it. So I mean, Belzer and Billy Drago on the in the same cast. I mean, that's worth the price of admission.
It's the pair you've always wanted to see.
Somebody's always wanted to see it. I don't know who, but.
Hey, we got Jay Leno and Pat Morita in a film together. We can get Richard Belzer and Billy Drago.
Yes.
And I should caution our audience that this is not the 1996 Kiefer Sutherland Freeway that you've probably seen 15 times on Showtime or Cinemax.
No, it's not. This predates that, and I'm not sure of the quality difference. I've never really seen the original Freeway, only in parts of it, but I'm sure it's got to be better than the 1996 Freeway, because I did not like that movie at all.
That's a film that was like made for late night Showtime Cinemax screenings.
Yeah. And then Kino Lorber is also putting out from 1990 The Last of the Finest. This is basically a group of rogue cops led by Brian Dennehy forming their own drug-busting team when they're taken off the force, when they get a little bit too close to a cover-up. The cast also includes some pretty good names in Bill Paxton, Jeff Fahey, and Joe Pantoliano. So I've never really seen Last of the Finest, Joel, but this seems like it might be a good one to check out.
Yeah, I haven't seen this either, but, I mean, just based on the cast, it seems worth a look, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on down the list from Shout Factory, a Blu-ray collection, a version of The Bat People from 1974. Basically, a bat bites a dude turns into a man-bat. This is something that I just recently caught on Comet TV, which is a great channel, by the way, if you don't have Comet TV, they have a Roku app. They also have, their website. They have live streaming from their website as well. So it's just a great little channel that you can get free over the air if you've got rabbit ears, if you can find it. It's just got some awesome stuff on it. And The Bat People is just one of those movies that, you know, if you're of a certain age, you might remember from late night, midnight movies on television. On your local UHF station, it's just one of those fun, silly, forgettable horror films that probably isn't even really scary, but it's still fun. And it's out on Blu-ray this week.
Yeah, this is what I mean to see for ages. I'm not sure. Is this one even in the public domain by this point?
Yeah, that's a good question, Joel.
I feel like I've seen it in a million collections.
I thought maybe MGM still had distribution rights over it, but I'm not 100% certain on that.
That's entirely possible. Because I know it's been released on a 2-pack with Beast Within, which definitely is an MGM film.
Yeah.
But the director of this, Jerry Jameson, also gave us Airport 77, Raise the Titanic. So if you're into 70s, early 80s cheese, this is definitely a film to look into.
Yeah. And then on the opposite side of the spectrum, In terms of quality, we go to the Criterion Collection, putting out this week from 1979 the final Soviet feature of the great Russian director Andrei Tarkovsky. It's Stalker, which is essentially like some sort of post-apocalyptic, surrealist sci-fi. I don't know much about this. I do know that if it's in the Criterion Collection, there's got to be something pretty arty about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with his Solaris. I haven't seen Stalker yet, though I've meant to for the longest time. I mean, I would say it's going to be hard to go wrong with a Tarkovsky film, given his renown.
Yeah. Yeah,
so. Although it's quite a long film, so, and based on his general tone that I've gathered, you're probably going to want a day where you have the energy to sit through something as dour as he can be.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you're not in the mood for the Bat People, then, you know, sure, go ahead, throw in Stalker.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to this coming week's releases, due out in July the 25th. We'll kick it off with probably one that most of our listeners are probably quite familiar with from the Warner Archive Collection. It's from 1993, Batman, Mask of the Phantasm, which was a full-length feature film spin-off of the Batman animated series from the 90s, so this is probably one that's on the target list for a lot of people, Joel.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's one of probably two films this week that need absolutely no explication. Like, if you don't know the Batman animated series and Mask of the Phantasm by this point, then you're probably just not into comics or into Batman.
Yeah. yeah, and then moving from there, Shout Factory is putting out the complete Billy Jack collection.
Yeah.
And what do we got? Is it three or four films here, Joel?
Oh, God. How many Billy Jacks are there?
Yeah.
That's actually a really good question. Really
Jack,
good question. Now.
Billy Jack, Return of Billy Jack, and probably Billy Jack 3, Revenge of Billy Jack.
Well, and there was the Born Losers, the first one that
I haven't looked. I don't know if that one's in this collection. I should have done my research there, Joel. That would be a good checkout on that one. But regardless, if it has Billy Jack in the title, it's going to be in this collection.
You sort of know everything you're getting. Yeah, it does have Born Losers, so hey, you are getting all the Billy Jacks.
Cool. I think there's like maybe, if including that, then there's probably four or five films in this collection.
Four of them. Because there was actually a bit of weirdness, if I remember, in the 80s where there was one that he was going to make that was unreleased. The filming wasn't completed or something.
Okay. I hadn't heard that story, Joel.
Yeah, if I remember, it was something about Billy. Yeah, it's called The Return of Billy Jack, and it's of course because it's the 80s. It's Billy Jack taking on child pornographers.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, we got to see this.
Someone needs to do a Kickstarter.
How long does it take to film a scene of Billy Jack just kicking in the door of these of wherever these guys are headquartered and just beating them all up? Close.
That's an 80s story. I would expect a sequel where he goes over to some vaguely defined Arab country and takes on a Shah or a Sheikh, because, you know, it was the 80s and we really couldn't be sure that there wasn't like crazy human trafficking stuff going on all over the place.
Can you imagine we can do like Take Him 4 with Billy Jack teaming up with Liam Neeson?
Oh my God. Oh, it's the dream.
It is the dream. We dream so much here at Go Home in the Box.
We're idealists, though. Yeah. We're romantics.
How about from 1994, we've got a Discotech Media release, an anime feature film based on the video game Fatal Fury, the movie.
I'm really curious about this, and I believe there were actually a couple of sequels to this. I mean, of course, they're anime, and I don't know like the general quality of them, but you know, if you're a fan of SNK fighting and beat 'em up games like I am, it's like this seems worth looking into.
Yeah. And so, yeah, fans of video games might want to check this out. If they haven't, if they didn't see this in the 90s, then here's their opportunity. Let's take a look at another Shout release from 1976. This one seems kind of fun. It's Scorchy, starring Connie Stevens as an undercover narc. But this has B-movie stalwart William Smith in the cast as well here, Joel.
And also a fantastically awful title.
You don't like Scorchy?
I mean, I love the idea that I could tell someone, not now, I'm watching Scorchy.
That's actually a good way to decide whether or not you're watching a good movie, based on the title. Yeah. What about this latest Severin release on Blu-ray, Beyond the Darkness from 1979? It's a Joe D'Amato film. This Blu-ray comes with a CD, which is basically the soundtrack as done by one of our favorite bands, Goblin.
I mean, that seems worth the price of admission alone, but, you know, a caution to our listeners, it is Joe D'Amato. So, I haven't seen Beyond the Darkness, but I know there's a lot of gruesome, gross stuff, a lot of weird sex stuff.
This is going to be sleazy.
It's going to be sleazy. I mean, it's D'Amato. You know, I'm not sure it's on the level of, like, Anthropophagus, but it probably is.
I've read reviews of it, and the reviews don't have, you know, nice words. You know, the word repulsive does not connotate something nice, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Boy, that's a word that gets used regarding him a lot. You know, basically with D'Amato, unless it's like an A-Tor film, you're probably not safe.
Oh, A-Tor. Oh, I got to go back and watch A-Tor again. I hope it's still on Amazon because, yeah, I got to see that. You know, the Cave Dwellers, you know, they did the Cave Dwellers on MST3K, which is actually like A-Tor 2.
Yeah.
So, yeah, awesome. Blue Underground has put out a new one this week. It's a Dario Argento film from the mid 90s, 1996. It's The Stendhal Syndrome, which stars Asia Argento. It's a 3-disc limited edition. It's limited, so get it now before it's gone.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, this might be one of the ones where they where Blue Underground then releases, like, you know, a more not quite a bare bones edition, but a less elaborate edition later on that's not limited. So, yeah, I'm not sure if I'd get. I haven't seen this. I haven't really seen any Argento more recent than Trauma, which was 93. But generally speaking, if it's anything Argento's involved with that Asia Argento's also involved with, you're probably going to be creeped out by how she's filmed.
Yeah.
Doubly so if she was underage when it was filmed, but this one, I believe she was an adult by this point.
There's definitely a creepy, you know, father-daughter thing going on there. So, yeah, proceed with caution on this one, you know, because if you know the backstory, then it's probably going to make you feel a little icky.
Yeah, no, it's... You know, maybe just watch Suspiria again. Just have fun with, like, Deep Red or something.
Absolutely. Lionsgate putting out the Warlock collection. You know, Warlock and then Warlock the Armageddon, Warlock... I think there's, like, 3 Warlock films. And we've got... we can put an end to the big debate of who's the better Warlock, Julian Sands or Bruce Payne.
It's a tough call. I'm a big fan of Bruce Payne for his appearances in the first 2 Dungeons & Dragons films.
Yeah.
And, you know, bonus points to him for killing Snails, the worst character in that film, in a film full of awful characters.
Yeah. I enjoyed Bruce Payne in the Brian Bosworth film, One Tough Bastard. Where Bruce Payne was, you know, he looks like Bruce Payne. He's got long hair, he's got a nose ring, and he's a And he's an FBI agent with that look. I mean, it's kind of awesome to see an FBI agent go against dress code there. That's how much of a rebel he was.
Oh, yeah. It was the style at the time. Now, a couple of interesting things about Warlock. First, the first one was directed by Steve Miner, who you probably know from Friday the 13th 2 and 3. And if I remember, it's produced by David Twohy, who did Pitch Black, did Below, which is one of my favorite underrated ghost films of the modern era. Wrote a ton of genre films before he got big doing The Fugitive, and then unfortunately Waterworld.
Unfortunately,
but he's still held on pretty well now. The weirdest thing about Warlock is that there was a Super Nintendo game.
There was?
I've never played it. I really don't know how. And I think it was also on Sega at the time, but it's strange. It's just strange that existed.
How did I miss that? I was a huge fan of the first Warlock film back when it came out in 89. And I miss that?
The game came out like much later. It was like mid 90s by that point. I think the game was more based on Warlock Armageddon, which, by the way, was directed by Anthony Hickox, who you might know from the two Waxworks films, yeah. Hellraiser 3, Payback. I mean, that was not the Payback. I was thinking it was the Mel Gibson Payback. It was a C. Thomas Howell Payback, which seems a step down from the Mel Gibson one.
It seems like a step down.
Because
C. Thomas Howell is only a notch below Mel Gibson on the pay scale.
Oh, I mean, agreed. the man who did Soul. If anybody understands racial insensitivity as much as Mel Gibson, it's the man who gave us Soul Man.
Yeah, absolutely. Tremendous stuff, Joel. What about, here's a doozy, from the American Genre Film Archive, and I'm not familiar with them, but hopefully we'll get more stuff from them in the future. They're putting out the 1971 film The Zodiac Killer. And now this was... there's an interesting backstory to this one, because they actually made this film as a way to, I guess, entice and entrap the actual Zodiac Killer. I mean, they went so far as to booby-trap movie theaters where the movie was playing.
Oh, it's insane. They had undercover cops hiding in, like, ticket boxes, like ticket booths. Like, they were, of course... all of these screenings were, centered on areas where the Zodiac Killer was thought to be active, so it wasn't just, like, entirely around the country. Let's just hope the Zodiac Killer walks in at some point. But, yeah, no, it's a very strange story. It's been screened on TCM once or twice, and I've seen it. It's, not a great film, but it's an interesting curio.
It is. And I really like the backstory revolving around it more so than the actual movie itself.
Yeah. Now, the American Genre Film Archive, I should say, is somewhat recent, but they've done a great job of restoring and screening a lot of older films on 35mm. They screen a lot of things at the Alamo Drafthouse in Yonkers in Brooklyn, yeah. I believe.
Cool.
So, and I'm sure probably the one in Austin, too. So they're starting to transition into releasing Blu-rays of some of the more obscure stuff they've gotten a hold of. They're a really cool. It's almost like they're less of a distribution company and more of like an actual archival company.
Yeah, so I'm going to look forward to more releases from them. I think because some of the obscure stuff is some of the best stuff. And that's more along the lines of, what we try to do here is, shed a little bit of light on some of the obscure stuff, and hopefully people will bite and go out and see it and, enjoy it, because The Zodiac Killer is definitely something that, the movie itself may not be that great, but I mean, you've still got the whole history behind it, and it's fun to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth it just to discuss just for such a weird story. I think probably Dangerous Minds covered that not too long ago. It's just kind of just a weird moment in film. I love the idea that like they tried to pull a Hamlet, like they're trying to instigate some sort of admission of guilt by the screening of a film.
Yeah, great story. And then Scream Factory, they've got a Blu-ray of one of our favorite films, Reanimator, and that's the movie that I just introduced Mrs. Jordan to, as well as Bride of Reanimator. She's a big fan of them now, so they're doing something right if she enjoys the movie.
Oh yeah, now I should say our next release is Scream Factory. This one's from Arrow, I believe.
Oh, okay, yeah, the Reanimator's from Arrow. My bad. The next one is from Scream, Slither.
Yeah. Now, both of these films, our listeners are probably very familiar with. I mean, if I need to tell you to go out and buy Reanimator, I don't know what the hell's wrong with you. But Slither, you know, has a lot of fans. It is a major cult favorite. Of course, its director is just James Gunn is just insanely successful right now, thanks to the two Guardians of the Galaxy films.
Yes.
You know, it's got a cult cast, like people are excited about. I mean, you know, I've never seen Firefly, but Nathan Fillion is the lead. Michael Rooker, of course. You know, who I'll watch in pretty much anything, but I honestly hate Slither.
Yeah, you know, Slither was a different kind of movie, and I can see it having its detractors because, you know, it is kind of, parts of it are, I guess we've got some misogyny in there, and it's just, so it has some controversial elements to it. I only slightly enjoyed it. I thought it was okay. It definitely went in a direction that I was not expecting it to go in, but at the same time, it was kind of a fun ride.
Yeah. Now, I should tell our listeners that Chris is mentioning that element because I was already bitching about it earlier. Slither is, to me, a ripoff of Night of the Creeps with a lot of weird sexual menace towards female characters and distortion of female bodies in a way that feels like it's not earned, because there's nothing really in the film about it. It's just kind of there to be weird imagery, and that's about it.
Yeah, so I mean, we're entitled to our own opinions here on Go Home in the Box, and we know how Joel feels about Slither. So you know, please, you know, if you have any emails, joelapuma@gmail.com. And I guess that... Yeah,
oh,
that,
God, I'm still going to get doxxed.
that rounds up the new releases for last week, or this past week, and next week. And so I guess we'll hit up the main topic now, Joel. Now, we've talked about this, and everyone enjoys a good car chase, especially when it's done well. You know, we've got the more recent Fast and Furious films, and I tend to not enjoy the car chase scenes in those films as much, because there's a lot of post-production stuff going on in there. You've got even got some CGI in a few, and I think what I'm going at here is like the practical effects from the more older films being superior to some of the newer style, because in newer films you've got like the shaky cam and you've got green screen and goodness, you've got all these things that kind of take you out of it. But you know, a lot of older films with their car chases, it's just they're filmed better. You know, you've got the camera down strapped to the car and it's low to the ground. You can actually feel the street, the road, you know, melting away, you know, on the screen, and you've got the roar of the engines. You know, a lot of these older films don't even put a soundtrack over a lot of their chase scenes, and we can touch on that. But it's just, you know, a man and his machine, you know, giving chase to a bad guy or whatever the case is, or trying to get to a destination in record time. And it's just a lot of these films have, I think they got it. They got it, and, you know, it kind of puts the chase films and current era films kind of to shame.
You know, I totally sympathize with that perspective. I actually do like the Fast and the Furious movies, but I totally get that, because especially in the context of having to consistently top themselves over the course of 8 movies, Stunts got more and more asinine, and I kind of enjoyed that. Like, I enjoyed the inventiveness and the strangeness of watching how ridiculous it could get. And I find those movies charming, because there's an earnestness about them that a lot of, like, other blockbuster sized films don't have. But yeah, it does take, like, there will be times where there's some very good action sequences in those, some very good chase sequences, but then they'll do something completely over the top. And I'm not even talking about, like, laws of physics. That does make me look askance sometimes, that, like, no one could walk away from that. At what point aren't these people superheroes? But no, there's a point at which you're watching those, and something obviously that's obviously film craft will happen, and it will take you out of the moment. And I think that's just kind of the nature of the beast at this point with watching anything modern in theater, because you've got such a big screen and such clear digital filmmaking that, like, the seams are so easy to spot.
Yeah, they are. And I don't want it to make it sound like I'm not a fan of the Fast and Furious films. I'm probably more of a fan of films 5 through 8 rather than any of the first four. It's more of a storyline, character development kind of deal with me. But I do enjoy the Fast and Furious films. But you know, it's just whenever I see a car chase in a newer film, I just harken back to when another era, when, you know, they got so many things right, so many little touches. And we've even got the new film out now, Baby Driver. And I haven't seen it yet. Have you seen it, Joe?
No. Actually, that was what inspired me to suggest this topic the other week. Partly because, you know, I'm just sick of Baby Driver already. Yeah. And maybe, like, Dunkirk will take away some of that, like, that conversation and point it towards an actual film made by grown-ups. But, and I'm not a big Christopher Nolan fan, but I have a certain fine level of respect for what he's doing with Dunkirk, that, like, Baby Driver is, like, seriously, guys, I know it loses credibility that I haven't seen it, but you're literally all, like, going crazy for a film about a guy's last big heist. Like, I get it. It's got cool music. You wish you had a record collection like that. Go to the record store. They're still making vinyl now again. Like, yep. go buy a record, or just go to Spotify or something. Like, you don't need to, like, vicariously live through some dork director's presumed coolness.
Oh my goodness, yeah, I haven't seen Baby Driver either. You know, of course we hear good things about it, but you know, again, I want to, you know, we want to take the opportunity to remind people that there was a time when, let's just face it, car chase scenes were just filmed better. And not better, but I mean, not to take anything away from Baby Driver, but you don't want people. I don't want people to think that, you know, Baby Driver suddenly is the greatest car chase film of all time.
It really does seem to be a lot. People online, like, even some critics, but mostly just like general fan discussion, were in that mode where like 5 years ago, like Drive was the greatest car film of all time. Like, and everyone kind of forgot that existed because now we have Baby Driver, which is now the greatest car chase film of all time. And it's like, hey, sometimes this stuff does stick and it does become like a legitimate classic over time. And not that things can't be instant classics, but I mean, yeah, it's safe to say if something similar knocked you off your pedestal like 5 years later, then maybe you weren't as good as you thought you were. But yeah, no, I'm very resistant to these sort of self-conscious sort of grindhouse exercises, like these very stylistic exercises when, you know, I'm not saying things were better before, like, you know, like I said, I'm a big Fast and the Furious fan because they're very earnest films. Like, they're just trying to be the film they are rather than trying to like evoke some kind of romanticized or distorted idea of what films were like 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, what we're talking about today is largely, yeah, this is a long lead up to that, but is largely, I would say almost like we romanticized that era of car chase films from like the late 60s through the 70s because they hit upon sort of a new era in how car chases, how automobile scenes were filmed, how they were edited. I mean, they came up with a bunch of new ideas in that era, partly because finally the capability of doing that, the expertise to drive that way, to film it that way, like just through years of development of doing fast scenes like that, finally hit a new peak. I mean, that's the thing. It's not that films were necessarily better in that era. It's that the years of trying finally led towards something new that really worked that well.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it, Joel, than how I put it. Not to take anything away from, you know, movies from current era, because I still love movies, but there is a difference in the style of filmmaking. One is more practical than the other, and in some cases, it looks more professional. I also want to touch base because you mentioned Grindhouse. You know, have you checked out the series on Sci-Fi Blood Drive? Have you seen any of that?
No, I haven't.
No, okay, because it's supposed to be kind of like an homage to Grindhouse era films. It's basically a cross-country race driven by cars that are fueled by blood. So it's kind of a unique concept, and it's kind of supposed to be a throwback to the era that we're referring to when it comes to you know, things like car chases and exploitation and, you know, the whole car exploitation era. It's quite an interesting concept, along with some modern touches, and it's probably something that you might want to check out. I recommend checking out Blood Drive on Sci-Fi. See if you can locate it online. With that said, let's get into some of these movies. Of course, I want to start off with, I guess, probably the number one car chase film of all time, or the number one film that contains a car chase, which of course is Bullet, starring Steve McQueen from 1968. And it kind of ties into a couple of other films that would come a little bit later, but we'll touch on that. But Joel, what do you think about the chase between Steve McQueen's Ford Mustang and the Dodge Charger at the time?
You know, I gotta say, Bullet is kind of a one-scene film for me.
Yeah,
like the rest of the film.
Yeah, it's very procedural. It's very slow-moving, like police procedural for the most part.
Yeah,
we see this case from beginning to end, and the car chase scene seems to be the, of course, it's the high point of the film, but it's also everything that happens before that is leading up to the car chase.
Yeah, it's definitely you know, it's that kind of thing we're talking about, where like films aren't made like this anymore because they don't have to be. Like putting together a scene of that complexity and that like that much detail, that much going on, like in 1968, must have been like just Herculean as a task. Like so by nature, like you can't really, you know, sort of pepper your film with like, here's a small action scene to like just keep it keep the action moving. Like it literally almost seems like it had to be a fairly, and you know, maybe like watching procedurals in 1968 was less of a, you know, less of a dull thing than it is now. But I mean, even then, I mean, you're talking like years after The Naked City came out, like it seemed pretty well worn by 1968 even. But I often wonder how much of an impact it would have made had they had the ability to do more action in this film. But the sequence is so good and probably so new at the time in terms of, like, I mean, in setting, you have, like, an action, you know, it's not like they're filming in Bronson Canyon or something where there are no people around and you could just go crazy. Like, they're filming, it's, like, on the streets of San Francisco. Like, it's just absolutely insane stuff, tightly edited, like, you know, create a lot of, because we have so many tropes and cliches of car chases that, you know, came into being during this era from Bullet and French Connection, the Seven Ups, all stuff we'll get to in a minute, and this like codified so many of them like first time out.
Yeah, and that's a good point. The thing is, one of the things I enjoy about this is, first of all, there's no score, there's no soundtrack overlaying the scene. It's basically just the sound of, you know, roaring engines and, you know, burning rubber, and it's just the way it was filmed. You've got you know, the camera behind the wheel of the car. It puts you in the audience, actually behind the wheel of the car. I mean, you can see out the windshield, and you can see them jumping over, you know, in the streets of San Francisco, the little hills that they jump over. You kind of get that roller coaster ride feeling from that point of view, and I think that was an interesting take on it.
Oh, yeah, I don't think it can be understated how revolutionary that choice was to do so much filming from the inside of the car. So, I mean, we're talking an era where, you know, it wasn't as common by the late 60s, but audiences were so used to shocks from the inside of the car being rear projection.
Yes.
Where, like, I'm sure even in, like, the 40s and 50s, rear projection looked pretty obviously fake, but I'm sure audiences were at least sympathetic to it because, you know, how you act well and deliver meaningful dialogue while you're trying to drive at the same time. But, you know, one of the big changes, of course, in American filmmaking in the 60s was a heavier reliance on actual location shooting, and which is also one of the things that Bullet instituted in action scenes. I mean, like, one of the things we'll see in these upcoming 70s car chase films is the presence of an actual city and the landmarks of that city. Yeah. And just the feel of that city. You know, so, and Bullet itself as a movie does that consistently, even beyond the car chases. And it's easy to take that for granted when you've got, like, you know, you can watch any, like, procedural TV show and get the same thing, basically. But it's easy to forget how new that was in many cases at the time.
Yeah, and another thing about Bullet, there's actually a couple of links that I want to discuss. The first one, one of my favorite scenes in Bullet is just before the car chase starts, the driver of the, we'll call it the bad guy car, because they're the ones we start the shooting. Bill Hickman is the driver. So Hickman is buckling his seatbelt just before he steps on the gas to take off and the chase is on. I mean, that was just an awesome touch to that preceded this chase. But it also brings to the front the actual driver, Mr. Hickman himself. And he's a renowned stuntman at the time, a stunt driver. And he would be used for several of these car chase films of the 70s. I mean, he would be the one behind The French Connection, starring Gene Hackman. The scene where Popeye Doyle is chasing the train. The overhead train while he's driving underneath it. Now, that's actually Bill Hickman doing the driving. And he also, in the film The Seven Ups, starring Roy Scheider, another scene, you can actually physically see Bill Hickman this time. He plays another hood, and he's the driver of the bad guy car, and that one as well that Roy Scheider is chasing. So, I mean, we want to just give a shout-out to the late Bill. He died at the age of 65. I think he died back in, like, it was sometime during the 80s. But he was only 65 at the time. But he was a very renowned stunt driver, utilized very efficiently in 70s-era Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that make this era what it was the presence of such incredible stuntmen, stunt drivers, Bill Hickman being the predominant one. I mean, his career stretched back to, you know, he was doing motorcycle stunts for The Wild One. Doing driving stunts for Rebel Without a Cause. He was a close friend of James Dean. I mean, by the time Bullet came around, he was already so established. I mean, you're talking about just a great confluence of new editing techniques, new filming techniques, and like stunt guys were just absolutely at the top of their game. I mean, it's just incredible how many amazing things Bill Hickman was involved in. I mean, one of the things that I think really needs to be taken into account is doing Bullet. Some of the speeds these guys were actually driving at. I mean, you know, occasionally they would reach over 100, 110 miles an hour doing these stunts.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's insane. Like, probably the reason why we talk about films going digital with stunts, that probably the reason why is that these things were incredibly dangerous to do.
Yeah. This was, like, it's definitely safer now to film a chase scene than it was, you know, back in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we like someone like Steve McQueen. I mean, he had a legitimate like racing background. He was in.
He did his own stunts as well.
Yeah, which would never be allowed today with the insurance policies like studios have on major actors. But I mean, you know, he was a very accomplished race car driver. And of course, one of the stunt drivers in Bullet was Bud Eakins, who was the one who did the Steve McQueen motorcycle jump in The Great Escape.
Yeah.
I mean, what we're talking about are, and I think part of this also probably has to do with the rise of motorcycle and stock car racing around the 50s or so.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these stunt guys are coming from the racing scene. Like, and of course, not just stock car, but Formula One. Like, there's a million variations of racing.
The 70s was the era of Evel Knievel. His popularity was, I mean, this guy was just, he was just a glorified stuntman, you know, pulling off these crazy stunts, and people ate it up. I mean, Evel Knievel was, he could command quite a large sum for making an appearance back in the day.
The man had his own pinball game.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, I'm always interested in how different industries sort of it sort of becomes synergistic like that, how one rising up informs another one, especially where movies are concerned. So, yeah, I mean, the rise of various forms of racing, probably starting in the 40s, and like even a bit before that, like car racing in Europe especially in Italy and France, was actually pretty common even before that. But I mean, started becoming huge in America around the 50s. I mean, there's definitely evidence of it beforehand. Yeah. I mean, you know, racing, especially in the South, has a long history dating back to bootlegging.
I mean, these things attracted a lot of, you know, rich and famous people. I mean, you got like races in like say a place like Monaco. There was a whole there was a whole circuit down, you know, in Monaco, and it attracted like kings and queens and princes and princesses and just billionaires and all sorts of, you know, famous Hollywood types. I mean, this was a very glitzy, glamorous thing.
Which made sense between the, you know, incredible novelty of it and also the amount of money that would be required to actually maintain and customize vehicles. I mean, this is an era before sponsorship of this kind of thing. I mean, we think of because of NASCAR's popularity in the South and rural communities, you know, racing has become sort of a degraded sport. Like people think it's only for I'd like to put it tactfully, but the perception is it's only for backwoods hits. I mean, yeah. A lot of our listeners have probably seen the South Park episode that skewered that stereotype a few years back, because the actual science involved in not that I'm a really big racing fan, but the actual science involved in it, the engineering involved in it, is just extraordinarily complex.
Yes, it is.
And then when you apply that to something as timing centric as filmmaking, I mean, you know, of course, one of the innovations during this era for films like Bullet was filming from multiple angles at the same time, because you would, you know, we're a far cry from the days where Hitchcock would storyboard out like every moment of a suspense sequence. And like where you could reasonably do that with the kind of sequences they are trying to put together, you literally had to film it from every conceivable angle, have a ton of experts with you to consult with who would actually be doing the driving themselves, who would coordinate the stunts. It was such a complicated process. It almost resembles engineering in a way.
Yeah, there is that calls to mind. You talk about camera angles. There's a scene in Bullet where Bill Hickman's car, he kind of cuts his turn too sharp, and he literally smashes into a camera that they're using for that scene, and they kept it in the movie.
Oh yeah,
probably for the authenticity of it. You know, there's a bunch of parked cars on the side of the street, and here comes Bill Hickman running around a turn, and he overshoots and he smashes into, you know, one of the parked cars, which is holding up a camera, and they left it in the film, and I just thought that was interesting because it did give an authentic feel to it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, that was fairly commonplace. And like you think of, say, Mad Max, the one sort of flame out sequence where the motorcycle rider gets smashed in the head with the wheel of the other motorcycle that's crashing, which actually led people to, you know, start an urban legend that guy died, like they would have kept it in the film. But no, it's just. There's a level that level of veracity that we're talking about. Unfortunately, it's incredibly dangerous to capture. But when you've got really experienced guys who are familiar with the risks and seem very comfortable with them, I mean, I don't pretend to understand like the stuntman mentality, even though there have been films about that, like, Stunts, which I think was Mark Lester, and Stunt Rock by, what's his name, director of BMX Bandits.
Oh, man. Yeah, you're going to dig deep for that one.
Which is the greatest film of all time, obviously. and Brian Trenchard-Smith, thank you. I've seen so many of his films, I can't believe it took me so long to remember him. Of course, there's the Stuntman with Peter O'Toole and Steve Railsback,
yes,
which is a phenomenal movie. That's one we really have to talk about at some point. That particular very almost mundane comfort with danger is always fascinating. And of course, the stunt coordinator in Bullet was Cary Lofton, who, you know, long-term racer himself, stunt driver. A lot of people, I'm sure, will know him because he was on screen as the truck driver in Duel and the truck driver in Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah. Let me touch base real quick with you on something here, Joel. So you've got, as far as Bill Hickman goes, we've got Bullet, and then we've got The French Connection, and then we've got The 7-Ups. Now, which, for you, which chase scene from each of those movies do you prefer?
Oh, tough call. I mean, The French Connection, the chase scene, is, like, just a brilliant concept. Just an impossibly difficult idea of this car has to chase this L train. Amazing concept there, and of course it's an intense Gene Hackman behind the wheel, which is always amazing. I think because I just watched the 7-Ups for the first time, and also, by the way, there's a shot by shot review of the car chase on YouTube. A lot of it's focused on continuity errors in terms of, like, the different places in the different locations in New York they cut to and from. So it can be a little nitpicky, but it really points out just how complex this was. I'd honestly say the 7-Ups one is my favorite because there's so many moving pieces to the scene, and the way they put it all together is just phenomenal.
Yeah, and the 7-Ups chase scene had the best ending of the three. Just that abrupt ending where Roy Scheider's car goes under the back of a semi truck and just shears the top off of his car. I mean, that was just the greatest. It was abrupt, great ending to that chase, and I believe that was supposed to be some type of homage to Jane Mansfield's death, from what I remember reading about that.
Oh, damn, that's really dark.
Yeah, sorry to take you down a dark turn, but I think in terms of how each chase ended, you know, in Bullet you had bad guy's car crashing into the gas pumps and exploding. Of course, the French Connection ended with Hackman getting out of the car and chasing the guy off the train and up some stairwell, and then, of course, the 7-Ups, just Roy Scheider nearly loses his head, crashing his car under the back of a semi-tractor trailer. And that would be my favorite ending to a chase right there.
Yeah, and, you know, that just seems like, as obviously difficult as the previous two were to film, the French Connection is probably, in terms of how of the actual narrative of the chase, is probably the strongest one, because it's the most centered on, like, one idea. But I really think, like, just the moving piece, all the drives into oncoming traffic onto the sidewalks, just the impossibility. Maybe this is just because, you know, I've lived in New York City at points, like, the impossibility of filming this thing just staggers me.
Yeah, and one more note that I want to get to. We talked about San Francisco and Bullet. Now, San Francisco, of course, is a setting for quite a number of chase scenes in movies, and probably because of the reason for what we saw in Bullet, you know, the hills that that roller coaster ride effect. What have we got? San Francisco in there was a David Caruso film in the mid-90s called Jade. And that had a pretty good chase scene in it, and that took place in San Francisco. And I think that chase scene was kind of like an homage to the one in Bullet. And then, of course, in Michael Bay's The Rock, we've got a chase scene in the streets of San Francisco. Of course, Michael Bay likes to use shaky cam in his, so not as big of a fan of that one. But, you know, just the fact that they're still driving, you know, fast cars through the streets of San Francisco, it seems to be like a recurring theme. It's like, hey, man, we need a chase scene, and let's shoot this in San Francisco because it's got, like, awesome scenery and infrastructure, and, you know, these streets go up and down.
Yeah, it just seems like tailor-made for a cool chase scene. I mean, of course people have done it a million times, even in Jade, which is like an erotic thriller.
Oh, yeah. I
mean, which is
Jade,
also...
Jade is not a great movie, but, I mean, there's a good chase scene in it.
Jade is one of the best wastes of talent I've ever seen. Like, because it's terrible, for the most part. Partly because it's a Joe Estrada's script, and... Yeah, it's
Yeah, that was that time period where David Caruso had split from NYPD Blue, and he thought he was going to be a big Hollywood star and a big leading man, and it didn't work out for him, and... Yeah. He didn't recover until CSI Miami.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Jade is a William Friedkin film with James Horner music. It's like, it's such a great waste of talent. It's like quite frankly, well, I mean, so is, that much of an extent, but Showgirls is also a wonderful waste of talent. Probably it's a more watchable film because it's more hilarious, but, you know, I'm always interested in anything Friedkin's gonna do, even if it's in the service of something as dumb as Jade.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we'll do here, Joel, let's take a break for a minute. Catch our breath on this, because we're at high speed here, talking about car chases. So we'll take a break, run a short promo, and when we come back on the other side, we've got more rubber burning to do as we talk car chase scenes in movies. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back. We're talking Burning Rubber. Car chases in movies. Movies with car chases in them. Movies about car chases. This is just the Hot Rod edition of Go Home in a Box. And we've got a couple of, different films with chases in them, Joel. Of course, first and foremost, let's talk about this one. We've talked about it before, and we both enjoy the film. Death Race 2000 is one of these. It's just like a cross-country race. The goal is, of course, to win, but you also can kill your opponent. And but the vehicles are the unique aspect of this one, as each vehicle is customized to whoever's driving it, which is a neat little touch.
Yeah, and Death Race 2000 is the first example we're talking about where it's a fairly low budget example of a car film. But yeah, like the ways they get around that are so brilliant and so new for the time. I mean, like you said, the idea of the cars themselves having a personality, like it's not just car porn for like guys who are really into cars, which is probably a significant portion of the audience for any car film. But like the idea that these are character cars, and they even worked to their financial advantage, because after the film was complete, they were able to sell the cars to a museum.
Oh yeah, awesome, yeah.
And actually basically make back more on that than it cost for them to customize the cars in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
But they also get by making it across this cross-country race, they can film in more desolate locations. You know, they could, you know, they don't, obviously the chase scenes aren't as complex as, you know, the Holy Trinity we just talked about with Bullet, you know, French Connection and the 7-Ups. But, you know, they're great car chases because there's a lot of personality to them. Like, the characters are interesting, the cars are interesting, all the details of the world around them and how that's affecting the car chases are very distinctive. Like, it's doing stuff that you can only do with this particular film, which is, or at least a film in that style, which is why the film became such a meme. I mean, you know, there are certain films that are ahead of their time in that they seem tailor-made for, like, a different medium. Like Death Race 2000 is like tailor-made for the video game era.
Yeah, it is. That would have been I think Death Race 2000 was probably 10-15 years before its time.
And they even made like 5 prototypes, I think, of an arcade game that just never got a full release. I don't know why, if it was just like violence concerns or what the issue was, but I mean, when you look at a game series like Twisted Metal, like, it's just Death Race 2000, the game.
Oh, yeah. That calls to mind one game that I enjoyed was Road Rash.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yes, Road Rash would take, Mad Max or Death Race and just, take it to the video game extreme, and you got weapons, and you can just, you know, knock each other off the bikes. Road Rash was an awesome game, dude.
Oh, totally. Totally. Had a lot of fun with that game. And I think with Death Race 2000, a lot of the lessons demonstrated by it in terms of how to make a efficient and fairly low-budget car chase film are seen in an earlier Corman production, Jack Hill's Pit Stop.
Yes, sir.
Which is one of his lesser-known films, but it did get a really nice Arrow release earlier this year, I think, maybe late last year. And, of course, that was from 69, so it's after Bullet. But, you know, it's a dangerous racing film, and, of course, you've got the benefit of actually filming like on an actual racetrack, figure eight track, and using actual like professional drivers. Con once I was asking Sid Haig about this movie, and because he was of course, and he mentioned that Jack Hill or Corman, I forget who, had called up like a local like Budweiser or Coors distributor and just had them deliver a truck of beer. Like I guess it was like when Barney Gumble wins the film festival on The Simpsons and gets the death truck and says, just hook it to my veins. It's pretty much like that. So they basically lured a bunch of professional drivers and bikers there just by having a giant beer truck, which also seems like the most dangerous possible thing, but it was 1969 and no one cared.
Yeah. You know, that's one way to put it. You know, you're going to attract some kind of suspicious element by just offering up a truckload of beer, you know?
I feel like that for a low-budget film like this only really improves things.
Yeah, but that's a great story behind that film. And then, of course, when we talk about personalities of the cars and whatnot, Death Race kind of leads into something like Mad Max, or more specifically, the Road Warrior. You know, you've got just that brilliant chase scene at the end of the Road Warrior. I think it comprises like the last third of the film, and you've got Lord Humongous and you know, Vernon Wells. Just the costumes of that film, you know, and the Doom buggies, the way the buggies are, you know, are made up, and it's just, and they're chasing Max in the semi tractor trailer, and I kind of think, you know, Death Race kind of segues a little bit into that with the personalities of the characters actually doing the chasing at this in this film.
Oh, absolutely, and it's also a film like the. Like we were talking about with French Connection, where there's a central point that everything in the chase is converging around. Like, of course, the semi truck in Road Warrior being that, and it also, like, unique to car chase films, it becomes almost a siege narrative at the same time, in the way that you know, Rio Bravo or Night of the Living Dead or Assault on Precinct 13 are. I mean, it's literally like a fortress that they're trying to defend in the middle of a chase scene.
Yes,
exactly. Which is just a really phenomenal concept. It becomes almost like this medieval castle siege where they're trying to, or it probably more accurately kind of a pirate ship attack. Like, it's probably got a lot in common with, you know, a lot of old Errol Flynn swashbuckler films.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, jumping from one vehicle to the other during, you know, mid-chase. And, I can see that. And just that added element to that chase, just like you said, the siege element, you know, guys, the villains trying to take the truck. And so, whereas in the films we talked about earlier, it's just the law, chasing down, you know, the crooks. This is more of, you know, the villain is trying to take something. And so, yeah, it just adds another element to a chase that was already great to begin with.
Yeah, it's just a phenomenally constructed sequence. I mean, just everything in that works so well. And then, like, the truck itself almost gains a sort of character to it when you're so invested in the safety of the truck itself.
Yeah. And of course, spoiler alert, the truck's a decoy the whole time. But yeah. we didn't know that, but that was awesome to see the conclusion of the chase when we see that sand pouring out of the truck and even fooled Max himself because he thought he was actually, you know, transporting gasoline. And so, I mean, it was another twist to a great chase there. Which, you know, when we're talking about weird sort of, you know, chases with the cars and Death Race and the bandits and the Road Warrior, it kind of sort of leads into this weird chase from another film that I've seen, and you've gone on record with me, Joel, and saying that you haven't seen it. It's from a Dirty Harry film, of all things. And in the Deadpool, there's a villain, a crook, who uses radio-controlled cars to claim his victims. He'll park a radio-controlled car under their vehicle and blow it up. Well, he's trying to pull that same stunt with Dirty Harry, and Harry's onto the game, and what ensues is one of the most odd chase scenes through San Francisco that you'll ever see. I mean, we were talking about Bullet taking place in San Francisco, we were talking about The Rock, we were talking about Jade. All of those are more standard chases. This one is really strange because you've got Harry Callahan in his sedan trying to avoid a remote control car chasing him through the streets of San Francisco. And if you don't see the Deadpool, Joel, at least find this scene because it's just one of those oddball rarity things that you will see that you probably never see. It's silly in concept, but the execution is just is there, and it was really probably the only enjoyable scene in the Deadpool.
I really feel like I'm gonna have to watch the whole movie around it because I really need to know how I'm supposed to take like the scene, the mood of this scene. I think that watching it out of context like that, I'm just not gonna have any idea what to make of it.
Yeah, well, you know, most of the Dirty Harry films are there's usually a good chase scene in each one, but nothing really memorable. I mean, Magnum Force had three motorcycle cops chasing Harry through San Francisco, so I mean, there's that. But you know, most of the Dirty Harry films are you take them at face value for what they are. I think you'll find that you'll enjoy them, you know, no matter where you stand on the gun fence.
My fence is more that I think Clint's persona and machismo work better in the Old West when I don't have to pretend he's a real human being. Dirty Harry, just like Clint in the modern era, just doesn't work for me the way Clint in, you know, an outsized frontier world does. Also, I don't think he was made for speed. He was made for ambling. He was made for sort of ambling along a trail, maybe galloping, but that's about as fast as I think Clint should be at.
I also wanted to give a shout out to a movie like The Cannonball Run, which I can't believe we didn't mention on this because that's a cross country race.
Yeah, we had a lot of cross country, very comedic action comedy car chase films. I mean, of course, there's Cannonball Run, there's, you know, my beloved Smokey and the Bandit.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah, that's another one that we've got to mention. That's a good one.
Yeah, it's almost like the advances made with Bullet and with the film surrounding it that Bill Hickman worked on. It's almost like the advances made by Bullet, made by the film surrounding it that Bill Hickman worked on and that Philip Yates worked on, Walter Hill, who did The Driver, which we'll bring up in a bit, was, I believe, a second unit director on Bullet. Like, it's almost like those advances made car films more accessible to work with again, and probably a lot to do with, you know, someone like Corman showing, and, you know, years of biker pictures as well, showing that they could be done on a budget.
Yeah.
But also, that there are ways to... There are ways to do them where you can disguise the cars can be an element and obviously a draw, but you can disguise them either like with Death Race, the cars being characters or tied in with the gimmicks of the drivers, or, you know, with something like Cannonball Run or even Smokey and the Bandit, where you fill it with famous people doing their shticks, like, you know, where the focus is on the famous people. The car stuff doesn't have to be elaborate. It just has to be entertaining and usually pretty amusing. And you know, like Smokey and the Bandit, I think, has some really tense chases. That's partly because you're really invested in the characters by that point.
Yeah, and with Smokey and the Bandit, we talk about Burt Reynolds, and it was probably nearing the end of his good old boy run of the 70s. And you know what I mean when I talk about the good old boy run. He was just in these, like, from Deliverance, White Lightning, Gator, just something with that just film made for people in the South. You know? White Lightning itself had a pretty okay car chase in it between him and Ned Beatty. That was... probably the high point of the
film. You know, this is also an era, what they call redneck exploitation, and it doesn't always have to be an exploitation film either, because, like, obviously something like Smokey and the Bandit or White Lightning, Gator, Deliverance, or even you know, on TV, of course, Dukes of Hazzard can be aimed at or involving a Southern audience. And it could still be fairly high budget or notable. You know, you also have a rash of bootlegging pictures around this time, or at least action films where bootleggers are the villains. Like, I think of The Devil's Eight, which was kind of like a Dirty Dozen-ish FBI chasing bootleggers film with a ton of car chases and Christopher George and Fabian for some reason. it's actually an awesome movie. Like, it, because so much of it is focused on, like, you know, it's all these prisoners that are going to get a pardon for being involved in this, and yeah, they're being trained as drivers, because the whole point of fighting bootleggers is you've got to outrace them, you've got to obstruct their routes. I mean, like we were talking about with the history of stock car racing arising from the history of bootlegging in the South. You know, this is a film that really caught on to that connection.
Yeah, and that calls to mind, you know, even before the 70s, we talked about the 50s and the 60s, and Roger Corman had his hand in this as well, you know, these hot rod movies where it was just, you know, the old black and white films where it was just teenagers and their hot rods, and, you know, so, I mean, the fascination with cars and it's always been there. I think really it took off after, you know, in the baby boom generation. Just, you know, the World War II is over, and, you know, now it's really where I guess materialism started to take off.
Well, it's also
off.
The era where sorry to interrupt, where advertising came to the forefront and sort of created the idea of the teenager. And I mean, if there's anything in that era that was intrinsically connected to youth culture, to the idea of what a teenager is, it's the car is a symbol of independence.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, the car chase film, whereas some of these films probably didn't have chases in them, but the idea spun off from there, I believe. You know, it starts off, you know, teenagers and hot rods. Maybe they have a run-in with a biker gang or something like that, or they got the you know, the old-time hot rod races that the kids would do. Someone would stand in the middle of the street with a flag or whatever,
and drop their
revving their engines. Drag racing, that's right. And so, I mean, I think the idea of, you know, putting car chases in films, I mean, it's always been there, but I mean, I think that era of film exploited.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's a central element of Rebel Without a Cause. I mean, that idea is so pervasive that street racing is an element in the Fast and the Furious films, especially the, you know, more, especially the more grounded early ones. But I mean, they put back, and I think maybe it was the seventh, where it's sort of like a going back to your roots kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, we've got a little bit of that going on as well. And, you know, at the beginning we talked about Baby Driver and the popularity of it. And you mentioned this movie just a few moments ago, but The Driver from 1978 with Ryan O'Neill. I think maybe more than likely unintentionally, but I believe what I know of Baby Driver probably takes a lot from The Driver itself in terms of the character behind it.
And I know Drive does too. I think Drive is more more open about being inspired by The Driver, which is interesting. So The Driver itself is heavily inspired by Jean-Pierre Melville's Les Samurai, which I've never seen. I really need to really binge on his stuff sometime soon. But yeah, the idea of a driver has almost like a mythic figure. I mean, they do a lot of cowboy comparisons in the to Ryan O'Neill's Driver. He's just literally named The Driver. Like,
yeah. Yes. Well, that's a movie that also has character names like the Mailman, or if you look at the cast listing for The Driver and you look at the character names, you know, The Driver is a lot similar to the rest of the character names. I just thought that was...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all like their names are their roles, basically. I mean, it's a bit, that sort of weird, you know, new Hollywood era action film where everything is kind of like terse and existential. Like, apparently the look of the film, which fascinates me endlessly, this fact was inspired by Edward Hopper's paintings. Which is funny, because as soon as I read that, like, I immediately saw, like, the way the lighting, like the famous painting Nighthawks that our listeners are probably familiar with, at least through references, you know, Google image search, you will recognize it. The way that contrast of, like, sort of mysterious foreboding and sensual, like, dark city landscapes with harsh interior lighting, like that kind of lighting contrast is present like everywhere in The Driver. It's just, you know, it's not, I wouldn't say it's as good as like the previous three we were talking about, but it's that sort of like terse style in terms of like the dialogue and the characterization sort of grates on you. I mean, I think the best part of this film, aside from the, you know, great driving sequences, is Bruce Dern, who I would describe as a slimy Art Garfunkel in this. He's just absolutely phenomenal. Ryan O'Neill's... apparently Bruce Dern is a better Art Garfunkel than Art Garfunkel, which means Art Garfunkel for the second time is in second place.
I think we've already said Art Garfunkel.
I know. It's more than I've ever said his name in over the course of my entire life, I think. But no, like, it's, you know, Ryan O'Neill's not bad. He does what you need to do. He's not like a magnetic, like Steve McQueen kind of presence, but you know, he's sort of like the guy you call when Steve McQueen's not there. But he's pretty decent at like that. He fits into the style. The female lead, Isabel Adjani, not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. She's not good, but I think it's a combination of her not working well with the style and her not working in her native language, because she's like an extremely renowned actress in France. I mean, she's won like 5 Best Actress awards, and they're like Oscar equivalent.
Yeah, no, she's. I think she's more renowned in Europe than she is in the U.S. And I think you're right. It's probably got something to do with her native language.
Yeah, and I just don't think the style, that terseness, like. Because the only other thing I've seen her in is Possession, which is, for anyone who's seen it, knows is just like an insanely overheated film. Like, I think she's done a lot of period pieces, a lot of like romantic pieces, like stuff that's more emotionally effusive. I don't think like this kind of very deadpan crime thriller noirish style is a good fit for her.
Right. Yeah, and so I would agree with that assessment. I mean, I've seen the Driver, and I think you've inspired me to probably review that film for the website soon, Joel. So, yeah, I'll watch for my thoughts on that in the very near
future.
Yeah,
there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. Of course, I mean, Walter Hill is always worth looking at. What's interesting is that this was a film that was critically excoriated when it came out. Like, I think they felt like it trying to be sort of a almost French New Wave take on a crime film, which is weird to complain about, because it's yeah. Like France already had tons of great crime and gangster films, you know, 10-20 years before this came out. But I think a lot of people felt that there was like a certain level of pretentiousness to it. Removed from that era where French films were like more current, I think it's less bothersome to someone who's seen a lot of those films, but maybe at the time critics reacted to it the way I react to Baby Driver.
Yeah, you know, I've seen the great Roger Ebert's review of The Driver, and he made a lot of the same points that you made in terms of Isabella Gianni and the dialogue of the film. So, I mean, I think the consensus is pretty clear on The Driver.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's definitely, and of course it's a film where the cult of it has really sprung up over time. I mean, Tarantino's a big fan, obviously. You know, inspired Drive, inspired Baby Driver. I think because it's like such an elemental approach to a car chase and heist film, like, I think it's very easy to reference and very easy to sort of pattern your own film around.
Right. And and you know what? This just came to mind, and we talked about Cobra at the top of the show. Cobra. Listen, anyone who hasn't seen Cobra, I recommend Cobra, because it's Sylvester Stallone. It's the 80s. It hits every 80s action movie cliche that you can think of, and except we don't have a buddy cop who's close to retirement. But but there is a chase scene in Cobra. Stallone's vehicle is some sort of retro 50s looking thing, and I mean the chase scene in this movie is not too shabby in its own right, and we've got Cobra in a parking garage, and he busts out of the parking garage and jumps down to the street below, and it's and it's the greatest thing ever. And I wanted to, since I'm still on a high here, I thought I could work that into the conversation, because they had a chase scene in Cobra, and I just love that movie. Oh man, I've been so inspired by that film. I'm not
kidding, so was Kenny Omega. that's my bone, by the way, my weekly bone to throw to our wrestling fans out there.
Kenny Omega reference. I'll make sure that Kenny Reigns is aware of that.
Let's not play this one for Jim Cornette.
Well, you know, Joel, we hit on quite a few movies in this topic, and they're all of varying quality, but they all have one thing in common, is that they had some great chasings in it. Do you have any others you want to hit on, Joel? Do you want to go ahead and recommend your great.
I mean,
chase
a movie. Quick shout out before I get to my great chase movie. Sort of a subgenre of these that we didn't quite touch on that probably belongs someplace else is the killer car film.
Oh yeah, the killer car film.
Which
that's right. Yeah, we've got the car with James Brolin. That's the first one that pops into my mind.
And of course, Christine is the big one. Stephen King's history with cars is kind of fascinating. The car is an interesting case where I believe that was a Universal picture, or at least in the distribution. So,
yes, it still is. Yeah, you can catch that on occasion on the horror-hosted program Sven Gulli on MeTV, because I think that is the latest movie that they've ever offered on that program.
Nice.
Yeah, it's like, 1977,
yeah.
I think. Yeah, and they have a contract with the Universal. They play a lot of the Universal monster movies, and the car has made the cut, and I've seen it a few times on that already.
And actually, the car is going to be played in August. I forget exactly what date, but for those of you around New York City, check the calendar for the Film Society at Lincoln Center. They're doing a Summer of 77 review in August, multiple films from that summer over the course of a number of weeks. The Car is one of the films they're playing, along with Eraserhead, Wizards, Killer of Sheep, and How Zoo. A lot of films. I'm gonna be there a lot, let's just say that.
You're going to be camping out in
pretty much. They're not going to be able to get rid of me.
You're the phantom of the theater. Right?
Yes. Of course, there's Killdozer. There's Duel, which is an interesting example of this, where it's very much like, of course, the title, appropriately for the title. I mean, it's not about a killer car so much as a killer guy inside a car and about him as a stalker using the car as his vessel for that, which is an interesting take on these films. So, I mean, there's more supernatural ones like The Hearse and Christine, or that segment in Nightmares where the demonic truck chases around Lance Henriksen.
Well, hell yeah. We forgot to mention the
Wraith
could be thrown in here.
A big fan
of
the Wraith. The only change I would make is not putting Charlie Sheen in it and replacing him with, say, mid to late 80s, Kyle MacLachlan.
Kyle MacLachlan would have fit in that movie very well, I believe. He's got that, that natural darkness to his
personality. And he's also very ethereal at the same time, and I think that combination would have been perfect. Charlie Sheen never seems like he could be from any other planet but like an alleyway. But Christine is obviously the big example here of the killer car film, partly because it's always hard to justify your killer car film unless you've got like X Duel, where there's specifically a driver. Or, something like The Hitcher, maybe. Even The Wraith had Charlie Sheen. Like, it's an instrument of semi-alien, semi-ghostly vengeance. Christine, liking the car to a woman, which is, first of all, is a very American sort of, like, car guy thing to do. And that the car almost has, like, this sort of romantic obsession with its own. I should say her owner, because the car is very feminized. I mean, of course, doing that with a 50s hot rod. And when you think 50s cars, you immediately think things like Lover's Lane. You think that first era of like, teenage romance, and of course it's a stand in for like, male agency too. I mean, I remember, cause I read the book way back and, Arnie, the owner of Christine, Keith Gordon's character, like, they describe, the book's narrated by his best friend, and he describes it, like, before he gets the car, he describes him in these really gruesome terms in terms of, like, his acne and acne scarring. I mean, quite frankly, Stephen King described him more gruesomely than he's described most of the monsters in his books. So, like, there's a lot of fascinating, like, very American, very teenage elemental things going on in Christine. Which would make the basic concept memorable, even if it weren't like John Carpenter doing it. And John Carpenter, like, I love what he does. I'm always fascinated by what he does with space, with, like, interior locations, with claustrophobia. And to adapt that to a car film, which is usually a very open, very wild thing, was really inspired.
Yeah, it was. I agree with that. One thing I wanted to mention, though, real quick, and this will probably take us off the killer car target here a little bit, but you mentioned feminizing the cars, and that reminds me of Gone in 60 Seconds, which is a movie that we totally forgot from the 70s, because in that, Toby H.B. Halicki, his character, Mandarin Pace, insists on giving all of their cars that they collect in the film female names, including the Mustang, Eleanor, the star of the movie. Because Eleanor gets top billing. If you notice the opening credits, Eleanor gets top billing. The Mustang is the star of the film. Of course, the thing with Gone in 60 Seconds is a very thin plot anchored by a near 45-minute car chase. That pretty much is why this movie's even on the map. It's a lot of improvised, shoddy dialogue from people with no acting skills whatsoever. But that chase scene is something to behold. I mean, he's taking a Mustang and he just beats the shit out of it. And, it has a very implausible conclusion to the chase. He's driving past a car wash that just happens to have another fresh Mustang, similar Mustang, and so he drives the beat up one into the car wash and steals the new one, and then the police all think that the car wash manager is the guy that they're chasing. So I mean, a very implausible ending, but everything before that was aces. I mean, Halicki knew how to shoot a chase scene, but as far as you know, the rest of the film goes, it is kind of hard to sit through up until that point.
Yeah, and speaking of Halicki, we talked about how dangerous these films were to do. Why it got moved to a digital venue. I mean, he died filming the unfinished Gone in 60 Seconds 2 during a stunt.
Yeah, he did. He did. I believe it was a utility pole or something that fell.
Yeah, I think it was some kind of tower, a pole or a water tower, something along those lines that was supposed to topple and the cable snapped too soon.
Yeah. So, one other thing I wanted to mention, I have a Halicki DVD collection. There's like maybe three films on it. There's The Junk Man. And there's a movie called Deadline Auto Theft. And basically what Deadline Auto Theft is Gone in 60 Seconds with scenes with Hoyt Axton added, spliced into it, as a cop trying to chase him down.
Thing.
And it includes the entire final chase scene. And I thought really it was useless, a useless piece of film that Halicki didn't need to make. And it really made me think that Halicki was just really undergoing these vanity projects just because he had the money to do it.
Listen, if you're making a vanity project and you don't hire Hoyt Axton, if I had the money to make a vanity film and Hoyt Axton's alive, I'm going to hire him and I'm going to have him sing at any provocation.
Yeah, bring that banjo. You may as well just film Hee Haw, the movie.
Listen, Hoyt Axton is a legend, goddammit. this is a berserk button with me. Hoyt Axton is one of the most underrated and diverse songwriters of the past 50 years. He is awesome. Go listen to his music, people. If you just know him from Gremlins, go listen to him.
Yeah, and then watch Deadline Auto Theft.
And think about how much cocaine Hoyt must have been on at that point. Because it was probably a lot.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead, Joel, and recommend our favorite movies from this topic. We'll start with you, of course, and then we'll get to mine. But you know, we want to bring to light some movies here that have some excellent car chase scenes in it, and hopefully you'll have some insight into these movies as we bring attention to them. So, what you got, Joe?
One that I held off on bringing up, and I think I've mentioned this on a previous show briefly. My favorite car chase film of all time probably is Dirty Mary Crazy Larry. And this is a 1974 film by John Howe, who just the year before did an extremely different film, The Legend of Hell House, which is also a totally underrated horror film that people should check out. Scream Factory has a very nice Blu-ray of it. He's probably best known for doing the two Witch Mountain films and The Watcher in the Woods for Disney. The cast here is phenomenal. Peter Fonda, Susan George, Adam Rourke. And Adam Rourke, did not do a lot of like notable films, but his notable roles like this and The Stuntman are like just absolutely phenomenal electric performances. He's just so good. And of course, Vic Morrow is the cop who's obsessed with, that's another thing, in these films. If it's about an outlaw driver, there's usually an obsessive cop. Like a Captain Ahab cop trying to track it
each movie has its Hoyt action.
Yeah,
that's
or
right.
You know, it's Jackie Gleason or Bruce Dern in The Driver. Just something, you know, cars in America are very much about like the American spirit, about freedom and independence. And by God, the system's always got usually a heavy set guy who isn't driving sometimes, but usually just like, you know, behind the radio at a police station trying to track this guy down. It leads to this absolutely brilliant scene where Vic Morrow has basically expended every police cruiser they have trying to get to them. And just every single one has crashed. You know, the Pier Fonda has managed to elude the cops, like in the sort of winding, very labyrinthian forest kind of road setting. And he knows, so Vic Morrow knows Peter Fonda's patched into the radio, so he's giving these fake instructions to police cruisers who aren't there, and trying to get Peter Fonda to outdrive himself to cause an accident just by virtue of trying to flee imaginary cops. It's absolutely brilliant.
That is a brilliant piece of psychology there.
Yeah, just everything, and just the performances in this are so, you know, there's so much edge to them. I mean, it's not like, you know, I like The Driver, but that sort of very stylized terseness does wear on you after a while. This is one where everyone, like all the characters are like, nothing's filed down about them. They're sloppy and they're strange. Like they're weird and funny and carrying around a lot of misery. And it's just that they're interesting people. They feel like people, where like very specifically in The Driver, everyone kind of felt like they were a type, like very, very intentionally.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry is a great pick, Joel. So, kudos on that choice. And, hopefully, people will check that out based on your recommendation. My own recommendation, I'm going to harken back to the 70s also, to one that we kind of sort of covered here on the show, and that's the 7-Ups with Roy Scheider. You know, kind of a police procedural a little bit, but a little bit more livelier, I guess, than Bullet was. You also had some morality elements to it in terms of how police should be handling criminals. And, of course, the chase scene in that film, probably my favorite chase scene of all time. I mean, once I saw it, I was hooked. I was hooked on this chase scene. And the reason being is, as I mentioned earlier, there's no score, there's no soundtrack overlaying it. It's just the natural sound of the car's engines and the tires on the asphalt and, chasing through the streets of New York. And the, as mentioned earlier, the abrupt ending to the chase where the entire top of Scheider's car is sheared off. He's barely able to survive this this chase. It's just a great scene, just a great build up to it. They find one of their, I'm giving spoiler alerts here, because in context of the film, they find one of their partners shot. He's locked up in the trunk of a car, and they see the bad guys getting away, and Scheider just immediately jumps into action. And, Bill Hickman was in the other car. This really sums up his run in Hollywood as a stunt driver, and is really the precursor to Roy Scheider's, pretty decent career as an actor as well. This was probably... the first role, he was a top build in this film. He's coming off of The French Connection, where he served as Gene Hackman's partner, but not featured as prominently as Gene, of course. And this, of course, precedes Jaws, where Scheider really came into his own as a star in the 70s. I just really enjoyed this film throughout, and probably the greatest chasing of all time in my estimation.
Oh yeah, I mean I could. There's a great argument for that, and it's also just a good film on its own. I mean, there's a lot of interesting actors. Roy Scheider is he's one of the least likely leading men. I mean, he's a very normal guy, but he's also got a very there's a reason why he tends to play so many cops, because he's got a very weary cop. Cop quality about him. But it's always, it's less surprising when movie star type like Steve McQueen, a cool guy like him, or a really obviously intense actor like Gene Hackman gets all obsessive. When Roy Scheider does, it's really interesting, and there's a lot of friction there between what you expect of him and what he's doing, which is why all that jazz, he was so phenomenal. There's so much going on in his eyes, so much going on with his reactions to things. He's just such a phenomenal actor. Also, so something I love to bring up. I'm not saying old movies are better. I'm saying old movies are craggier, more they're the actors in the 7-Ups have so many lines on their faces, and they're so craggy. Now, you make a movie like that, and it's filled with guys who look like Ryan Gosling, you know?
No, exactly. That's a good point. The people, the actors, the cast in these films from an earlier era actually looked like adults. They had years on their faces and in their bodies, and whereas in this current era, you've got almost perfect human sculptures.
Everyone's so pretty and muscular. It's exhausting.
It's kind of, and it can take you out of it sometimes. It's oh yeah, right. I believe this guy has, got this kind of problem, So there's an era where just the cast looked like people who had been through things. You know what I'm saying? That's one of the likable things about Roy Scheider and most of the characters that he's played.
Yeah, that is something I'd like to see come back. And I almost think, I give Christopher Nolan a lot of crap for his pointless, playing around with timelines and his very hit or miss continuity in his editing. But, I am excited for Dunkirk, because even though there's a lot of pretty British men, it's centered around Kenneth Branagh and Mark Rylance.
Yeah. Okay. And that's our rant for the week.
I've ranted a lot today.
Yeah. Maybe we should do a show that's nothing but rants.
Just give me topics. I'll yell about it for a while.
The all yelling yes. episode. Coming soon.
It's probably just going to be me yelling Cobra for 2 hours.
I'm gonna need to line my room with egg cartons to keep the soundproof my room.
We'll get some of those gold components for our microphones. Really audiophile this up.
So yeah. All right. So I guess that concludes another show this week, then, Joel. Another good one, as always. And thank you for your input and your time. And you can find us again on iTunes and Stitcher, Google Play, under the Place to Be Nation Pop umbrella. So look for us under there. We try to have the show up usually on Wednesday or Thursday of every week. So if you're not subscribed to us, seek us out and look for each new episode around that time of the week. For Joel LaPuma, I am Chris Jordan. Thank you for listening. And remember, you're a mom-and-pop video store because it is the cornerstone of all your nostalgia. Thank you once again. We'll see you next week.